You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Caveat, N2K CyberWire's privacy, surveillance, law, and policy podcast. I'm Dave Bittner, and joining me is my co-host, Ben Yellen, from the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Hey, Ben.
Hello, Dave.
On today's show, Ben and I dig into the recently announced antitrust case the U.S. Department of Justice has launched against Apple. While this show covers legal topics and Ben is a lawyer, the views expressed do not constitute legal advice. For official legal advice on any of the topics we cover, please contact your attorney. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. All right, Ben, this is one of those stories you and I often behind the scenes refer to it as we light up the bat signal.
It's right? A bat signal story, for sure.
Right. Like this is one that it demands our immediate attention with its timeliness and its importance here. So
we will not let our listeners down.
There you go. Why don't you start off with a sort of a broad description here. What exactly is the action that the DOJ is taking here against Apple?
So the Department of Justice, along with 15 state attorneys general and the attorney general of the District of Columbia, has sued Apple for alleged federal and state antitrust violations. What we've seen so far is an 88-page complaint. I looked through it as closely as I could prior to recording this. What we do not have yet is an official response from Apple. So they issued kind of a press release responding to the general charges and the complaints. But over the next month or so, they'll have an opportunity to file an answer with the court. Once we get an answer and we dispense with preliminary motions in this case, which could take months or years, we'll either get a settlement or we'll get a resolution on the merits. So the first thing I should say is this is going to be a long-term case.
Yeah.
We're going to be in extended litigation for a while.
Anybody who went through the Microsoft case back in the, I guess it was the 90s, right?
Yeah, like late 90s. I mean, we're looking along those timelines, and
right.
I feel like our legal system is even more clogged than it was then. So
oh, goody.
It could be significantly worse.
Okay.
So what is the nature of the complaint? It goes back to a late 19th century law called the Sherman Act. And the Sherman Act reads that every person, and for the purposes of antitrust law, person also refers to corporation, who shall monopolize or attempt to monopolize or combine or conspire with any other person or persons to monopolize any part of the trade or commerce among the several states or with foreign nations, shall be deemed guilty of a felony. There are basically two elements to a charge under the Sherman Act. The first is that you actually have to have monopoly power in a relevant market. The big question there is what counts as a relevant market. So the allegation here from DOJ is basically it's the App Store market, both within the United States and globally. And then the second element is willful acquisition or maintenance of that power as distinguished from growth or development as a consequence of a superior product. So this is really the factor that I think trips people up. There has to be some kind of action taken on the part of the company that's being accused of monopolizing to secure that monopoly, other than just simply having a better product. What Apple is going to argue here is that the reason they have this 60-70% market share is that they have a better product. It is more user-friendly. They released the first smartphone before there was any Android smartphone device. If I'm not mistaken, the iPhone had already been released. And people have been loyal to this product because of how effective it is. The allegation is that Apple has taken various measures that are anti-competitive in nature. So there are a bunch of those measures that they list. I'm going to start with my favorite one because I think this is just the best example and something that
okay.
Everyone will understand. Can you guess what I'm going to talk about first?
Uh,
maybe messaging?
Green bubbles.
Green bubbles.
It's the green bubbles.
Okay.
So, Dave, have you ever been... We are both iPhone users.
We are iPhone users.
Have you ever been in a group messaging chat with a bunch of individuals and one person, we all know who they are, does not have an iPhone?
Yes. In my life, that one person is Joe Kerrigan. My co-host.
Throw
on
him
Hacking
under
Humans.
The bus there. I'm not going to throw mine under the bus because that person happens to sign
Joe is proudly not an Apple user. In fact, Joe, anyone who listens to Hacking Humans will know that Joe refers to Apple users as the Apple cult. So that he lays his biases bare proudly.
Well, I'm a member of that cult, maybe not willingly, but I've certainly drunk some Kool-Aid the years. So when you are communicating in that type of chat environment, when it's just you and other iPhone users, everything is seamless. You get the blue messages. You can use the Messenger application on your Mac device or on your iPad, your tablet. The videos and pictures that you exchange are of the highest quality. The way that Apple has designed its software is that if there is a non-Apple user that is a part of that conversation, a lot of that functionality is lost, including the ability to send those super high-resolution photos and videos and the inability to be seen on the Messenger app on a desktop or on an iPad.
You also lose a lot of your security because it's no longer end-to-end encrypted.
You no longer have end-to-end encryption. That's exactly right. So Apple has kind of said, like, we're in the process of fixing this. And, you know, maybe they're just saying that under the threat of this litigation. There are murmurs that they're making changes here. But I feel like that is the most concrete, easy to understand example of anti-competitive practices that Apple has taken, making life more difficult for non-Apple users.
Yeah, to be clear here, I mean, I think the technical issue here is that Apple does not make the SMS functionality, your cellular provider messaging functionality, Apple does not make that available on their platform outside of Apple's own messaging app.
Right.
So iMessage, the messaging app, that's the only thing on your phone, if you have an iPhone, that has access to that. And the DOJ is saying that that is restrictive by not allowing third-party app makers to also have access to that. It takes away their ability to fall back to that technology. It makes it harder for them to have a seamless, cross-platform communication kind of thing. And so DOJ is saying that restriction is problematic here.
Yeah, and then there's some other anti-competitive practices that they allege. One of them that was interesting to me was the Apple Watch. So I do not have an Apple Watch, but it is a beautiful accessory you can put on your wrist.
I'm looking at mine right now. It is quite nice.
Yeah. And it integrates very nicely with your iPhone.
Which is the point.
Which is the, of course, the point.
Right.
So if a phone call comes in, your watch buzzes, your iPhone buzzes, they're all integrated, send and receive messages on both.
I consider my Apple Watch to be an iPhone accessory.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, perhaps the right way to interpret it. The allegation that the DOJ is making is that Apple has made it too hard for third-party smartwatches to pair with iPhones so that they can receive those notifications.
Right. And that things like Apple Watch get exclusive APIs, exclusive conduits between the phone and the watch that third-party watchmakers don't get. They don't get access to that. Yeah.
Meaning that it's going to be a lot more difficult for those third-party watchmakers to compete in a market where Apple has 60-70% market share.
Right.
So I think there are two critical questions that have to be answered in this case. One is sort of the sphere of the monopoly. What specific market are we talking about here? Does it relate to applications? Does it relate to the use of smartphones writ large? That also relates to the threshold level. So these estimates that I've been mentioning on market share are just estimates. And there is no well-settled case law about how high a threshold in terms of monopolization a company has to reach before it is in violation of the Sherman Act. So the Sherman Act doesn't say you have to have 80% market share.
Yeah.
I read you the only two elements that are basically at issue in the Sherman Act, and none of them reach that threshold. So a court is going to have to determine is this actually a monopoly when there is a pretty serious competitor here, and there aren't really significant barriers to entry for new players on the market.
There's an interesting little thing that DOJ did where they sort of invented this category that they call performance mobile devices, performance phones. And by putting Apple in the performance category, they say that Apple has a 70% market share of that, rather than the 65% market share of all phones, right?
That was interesting to me, too. I don't know how they can do that.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
One thing that has been interesting to me as I've been reading through these articles and trying to get up to speed on it myself is, from a high level, this point of view that something that is a legitimate business practice becomes problematic when your company reaches monopoly size and influence.
Yes. So, you know, if you think about functionality, I'm trying to picture just like a wide open industry. So let's think about, I don't know, hotels and reward systems, right? There are a lot of different hotels. Obviously, there's been some agglomeration, and now you have super companies that have similar rewards programs. But the market is big enough in those circumstances that it's easy to enter and exit the market. The consumer has a lot of choices. So anti-competitive practices that we might allege as part of this DOJ complaint, when applied to that kind of scenario, wouldn't be such a big deal. Oh, you can only get rewards points if you stay at, you know, these particular hotels at this particular time. We don't accept rewards points from other hotel chains. Obviously not a problem in a market that has a lot of different players. That's just, that's good business acumen, right?
Right.
Building customer loyalty.
Yeah.
But yeah, when you get into the situation where one company is on the precipice of monopoly power, those types of anti-competitive actions are going to be put under the microscope because they've reached that threshold in the market. So again, we just have to determine whether they have actually reached that threshold and in what market. And that's, I think, going to be the first major issue to resolve here before we get to, are these actually the type of anti-competitive practices that would qualify under the statute?
All right, we're going to continue this conversation after we take a quick break. Stay with us. Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. I want to share a quote I pulled here from Nick Heer, who is the author of a website called Pixel Envy. It's kind of a tech punditry kind of thing. But he does have some specialization on covering Apple things. And I'm going to quote him. He says, "What is the goal here? The government's position is not that Apple should reduce the capabilities of its own products, but that Apple should not so aggressively restrict third-party capabilities. What if other smartwatches or tracking devices or headphones worked better with iPhones? Maybe not entirely to Apple's first-party standards, but, you know, better. That sounds like a more preferable solution than one in which consumers are compelled to remain within the confines of first-party products, allegedly because of deliberate attempts to avoid competition." I think this is a really nuanced observation here of what I think is at play. Because I think a lot of folks, particularly Apple fans, are coming in this from the point of, well, I like my Apple devices.
Cult members like us.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I'm okay paying a premium. I'm okay with there only being, like, there only being one iMessage on my phone. Well, that doesn't keep me from doing anything. There only being one wallet on my phone doesn't keep me from doing anything because it's great. The government is saying, okay, but how do you know that there aren't better things? Like, they may be great and that may be true.
But let the market figure that out.
Well, right. But that Apple is maintaining their position by, I guess it's that those two things aren't mutually exclusive. Apple can still be making great things. If you're a user and you think this is great, super. But they're restricting any competition, which I guess you could make the argument could lead to Apple being lazy or, you know, letting things fall by the wayside and consumers not having any choice because they are so locked into the platform because they bought an Apple Watch, because they bought Apple headphones, because, you know, all these kinds of things. And that is part of what is at play here. Do you agree that there's something to this this approach or this description that Nick Hare is making?
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I definitely think there's something to it. I think that's why the DOJ and the attorneys general here have initiated this action, is that, you know, they're welcome to take practices that improve their portion of the market share as long as they are not unduly restricting activity from third-party app developers, for example, in a way that doesn't give consumers additional options because people are just so locked into these Apple products. So yeah, I think that's very well said.
Another bit of sort of tech punditry that I wanted to get your take on. John Siracusa, who's well-known in the Apple world, is one of the co-hosts of a well-known Apple tech podcast, was making the point that there are two ways to come at something like this. One is in terms of the government having a problem with the way Apple is doing things. One of them is this way, which is the DOJ suing them. The other way would be through legislation.
And this was a great point.
He was making the case that legislation is the better way than a lawsuit.
Yeah, and the EU has passed legislation kind of along these lines to restrict these anti-competitive practices.
Right.
What's the problem we've brought up a million times on this podcast? Have you seen our Congress?
Right.
Have you seen the individuals that occupy seats in our Congress? We can barely pass a federal budget before the government shuts down. We have these deadlines, you know, to simply keep the lights on at government agencies every few months. It took the House a month to depose of their speaker and elect a new speaker. So this is a great example of where the complete dysfunction and our inability of our Congress to do anything of any consequence, unless their backs are against the wall and we're facing government shutdown or a potential default, this is where it really comes back to bite us. I completely agree that this would be better decided in the policy realm among policy experts. I think many judges would say that in a decision about this. They would say this is an issue best left to our legislatures. Now, state legislators, I think, are decently well situated to come up with these requirements. But then you get into compliance issues, having 50 separate state statutes, that sort of thing. So, yeah, this is the perfect example of where the vacuum resulting from federal inaction ends up hurting all of us, the entire industry, and I think is really, I don't want to overstate it, but I think it's the proximate cause of this lawsuit.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Siracusa was trying to illustrate was that when you make legislation, you can lay out exactly what you want,
mm-hmm.
right? You can be verbose, whereas when you're going back 120, 130 years to the Sherman Antitrust Act, that's a blunt instrument.
Right. And you're confined to what's in the existing statute, which obviously was invented before automobiles, let alone the internet.
Yeah.
So you are confined by that. You are confined to the specific issues that have been raised against one single company, as opposed to addressing this as a public policy problem, which is the way it should be addressed.
And I think that, you know, the Sherman Antitrust Act goes towards monopolies. And I think most people would look at the situation we have and say, well, that's a duopoly.
Right.
But the laws we have don't address that. So we're using a not entirely appropriate laud come after someone that doesn't exactly reflect the situation that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, and I think ultimately that might be where their case fails, or at least what causes a settlement more along Apple's terms and on the DOJ's terms, is the fact that to a layperson, this is not a monopoly. There is another major player in this market. And the other major player in this market, it should be noted, is much better at, you know, having good relationships with third-party developers, having ways to download applications outside of the App Store.
It's a much more open system.
It is a much more open system. So I think what a court might say is consumers can decide whether they want that open system.
Yeah.
They have another option. They can take that other option.
Right.
Yep.
Right. I think part of the DOJ's point here is that if you find your way in the Apple ecosystem, Apple does everything in its power to make it harder for you to switch. But that's in Apple's best interest, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Where do you think this is going to go, Ben? Let's just start high level. Do you think the DOJ has a case here?
Yes. I don't think, you know, Apple would succeed on a motion to dismiss. I think this is a well-pleaded complaint, 88 pages worth of evidence that they've accumulated. So, yes, I do think there's a case. Whether that case will ultimately be successful, I think, depends on the factors that we mentioned. For a variety of reasons, it might be in Apple's best interest to settle. And a settlement could take a bunch of different forms. They could pay some sort of monetary penalty.
Right. Go through their couch cushions.
Exactly, which is all it would be to Apple, right?
Right.
And then the other option is to come up with some negotiation with the DOJ and all these AGs from the various states to actions that they could take to curtail some of these anti-competitive practices. So in other words, all of the conversations we have in our group chats, even with non-iPhone users, will be blue and full of beautiful, pixelated pictures and videos.
Right. Right.
So that might be a result of some type of settlement. Settlement would come sooner than an actual case. I mean, with a case, we're talking about years of discovery and dueling motions and blah, 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 you know, and then this is just a complaint in a federal district court. So that could be appealed to the appeals court. And
with a company that is as famously private as Apple is, do you suppose that the notion of discovery, of having, you know, executive emails put out there in public would have a serious influence on their desire to get this over with?
Totally. And that's why I think there's a good chance at settlement. You know, before we get to the embarrassing things beneath the bowels of Apple headquarters in Silicon Valley, let's just put a nip in this bud and settle. I don't really think settling, this is just my personal opinion, but would it really hurt Apple's bottom line that much if they were a little more accommodating to non-Apple users of third-party applications?
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I just think, Apple's culture is very much that they know best.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's going to tell them, like, you know. So that's where I think there's going to be an emotional sticking point with many of the powers that be at Apple, that they're going to, you know, maybe they just have to, you know, grit their teeth and bear it. But I guess my point is, don't underestimate the importance on the high levels of Apple of fighting this for the principles of it, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And that we've seen them do that before. We know the most high-profile example was Apple v. FBI in 2015. And
right.
Would have been easier for them to just sweep it under the rug, give the FBI the access that they were requesting, but they stood on principle.
Yeah.
And they didn't win in that scenario. The FBI was able to obtain the information using other means, but I think it helped Apple's reputation as we have principles that we're going to fight for.
All right. Well, more to come for sure. several years more, I suspect. Who knows?
This is going to extend the life of our podcast. It's going to go on so long.
Who knows? No, it's fascinating. Lots of opinions, lots of hot takes. But I am glad to have you to bounce all of this off of. that is our show. We want to thank all of you for listening. Quick reminder that N2K Strategic Workforce Intelligence optimizes the value of your biggest investment, your people. We make you smarter about your team while making your team smarter. Learn more at n2k.com. Our executive producer is Jennifer Iben. This show is mixed by Trey Hester. Our executive editor is Peter Kilpe. I'm Dave Bittner.
And I'm Ben Yellen.
Thanks for listening.